opposite. All three airports serving London, Heathrow, Gatwick, and Stansted, are owned and managed by one company, the British Airports Authority, BAA. But within each airport, different functions are controlled by different bodies. The BAA owns and leases the shopping areas. The police are in charge of security, but the BAA provides the physical setup of the security checks. A regulatory agency sets landing fees, and so on. No wonder incentives are dysfunctional. The BAA profits from the leases on shops and so provides too little space for security checks. The regulator sets landing fees too low with the aim of benefiting consumers, but this causes too many airlines to choose Heathrow, which is nearer central London, and so on. Both authors have suffered from this, along with millions of other users of these airports. Turning to an application even closer to the author's experience, are teaching and research substitutes or complements? If they are substitutes, the two should be performed in separate institutions, as is done in France, where universities do mostly teaching and the research is done in specialized institutes. If they are complements, the optimal arrangement is to combine research and teaching within one institution, as is the case in major U.S. universities. The comparative success of these two organizational forms is evidence in favor of the complements case. Are the multiple tasks performed within the new Department of Homeland Security substitutes or complements? In other words, is that department a good way to organize these activities? We do not know the answer, but it is surely a question deserving careful attention from the nation's top policymakers. Competition between workers. In many firms and other organizations, there are many people simultaneously performing similar or even identical tasks. Different shifts work the same assembly line, and investment fund managers deal with the same overall market conditions. The outcome of each task is a mixture of the person's effort, skill, and an element of chance. Because the tasks are similar and performed under similar conditions at the same time, the chance part is highly correlated across the workers. If one has good luck, it is likely that all the others have good luck too. Then comparisons of the outcomes produced by different workers yield a good indication of the relative efforts and skill exerted by them. In other words, the employer says to a worker who pleads bad luck to explain his poor outcome, then how come the others performed so much better? In this situation, incentive schemes can be designed based on relative performance. Investment fund managers are ranked based on how well they do relative to their peers. In other cases, incentives are provided by a competition, with prizes for the top performers. Consider the professor who employs a student to correct the proofs of his book. He can hire two students, who do not know each other, and split the work between them, but with some overlap of pages to be corrected by both of them. A student who finds only a few errors in the overlap segment will be proved to have been slacking if the other finds many more. So the payment can be based on the relative performance on the overlap to sharpen the incentives. Of course, the professor should not tell each student who the other is, else they can collude. Nor should he tell either what pages overlap between them, else they will be careful with that part and careless with the rest. Indeed, the inefficiency caused by the overlap can be more than offset by the improved incentives. This is one of the advantages of dual sourcing. Each supplier helps create the baseline by which to judge the other. For this book, Barry distributed copies to students enrolled in Yale's undergraduate game theory class. The reward was $2 per typo, but you had to be the first to find it. This obviously led to massive duplication of effort, but in this case, the students were reading the book as part of the course. While many students did well, the big money winner was Barry's assistant, Catherine Picciotta. The reason she did best wasn't just that she found the greatest number of typos. The reason was that, unlike the Yale students, she thought ahead and started at the back of the book. Motivated workers. We have assumed that workers don't care about doing the job well for its own sake or about the employer's success other than how it directly affects their pay and careers. Many organizations attract workers who care about the job itself and about the success of the organization. This is especially true in nonprofits, healthcare, education, and some public sector agencies. It is also true of tasks that require innovation or creativity. More generally, people are intrinsically motivated when performing activities that improve their self-image and give them a sense of autonomy. Going back to the example of the student reading proofs, a student willing to do an academic-related job on campus for relatively low payment instead of more lucrative outside jobs, for example, as a software consultant for local businesses, may be more genuinely interested in the subject of the book. Such a student has intrinsic motivation to do a good job of proofreading, and such a student is also more likely to want to become an academic, and therefore will be more aware of and more strongly motivated by the career concerns mentioned above. Intrinsically rewarding tasks and do-good organizations need fewer or weaker material incentives. In fact, psychologists have found that the extrinsic monetary incentives can diminish the intrinsic incentives of workers in such settings. They come to feel that they are doing it just for the money, rather than for any warm glow that comes from helping others or from the achievement itself. And the existence of material penalties such as lower pay or dismissal for failure may undermine the enjoyment of doing a challenging or worthwhile task. Yuri Gnisi and Aldo Rusticini conducted an experiment where subjects were given 50 questions from an IQ test. One group was asked to do the best they could. Another was given 3 cents per correct answer. A third group was rewarded with 30 cents per correct answer, and a fourth was paid 90 cents per correct answer. As you might have predicted, the two groups being paid 30 cents and 90 cents both outperformed the ones with no bonus. On average, they got 34 questions right compared to 28. The surprise was that the group with only 3-cent payment did the worst of all, getting only 23 right on average. Once money enters the picture, it becomes the main motivation, and 3 cents just wasn't enough. It may also have conveyed that the task wasn't that important. Thus, Gnisi and Rusticini conclude that you should offer significant financial rewards or none at all. Paying just a little might lead to the worst of all outcomes. Hierarchical organizations. Most organizations of any size have multiple tiers. Companies have a hierarchy of shareholders, board of directors, top management, middle management, supervisors, and line workers. Each is the boss of those lower down in the hierarchy and in charge of providing them with the appropriate incentives. In these situations, the boss of each level must be aware of the danger of strategic behavior among those lower down the hierarchy. For example, suppose the incentive scheme for a worker depends on the quality of the work as certified by the immediate supervisor. Then the supervisor passes shoddy work in order to meet a target to get his own bonus. The supervisor can't punish the worker without also hurting himself in the process. When the upper-level boss designs incentive schemes to mitigate such practices, the effect is generally to weaken incentives at those levels, because that reduces the potential benefit from deception and fraud. Multiple owners. In some organizations, the control structure is not a pyramid. In places the pyramid gets inverted, one worker is responsible to several bosses. This happens even in private companies, but is much more common in the public sector. Most public sector agencies have to answer to the executive, the legislature, the courts, the media, various lobbies, and so on. The interests of these multiple owners are often imperfectly aligned or even totally opposed. Then, each owner can try to undermine the incentive schemes of the others by placing offsetting features in his own scheme. For example, a regulatory agency may be in the executive branch while the Congress controls its annual budget. The Congress can threaten budget cuts when the agency responds more to the wishes of the executive. When the different bosses offset each other's incentives in this way, the effect is weakness of incentives in the aggregate. Imagine that one parent gives a reward for good grades and the other a reward for success on the athletic field. Instead of working synergistically, each reward is likely to offset the other. The reason is that as the kid spends more time studying, this will take some time away from athletics and thus reduce the chance of getting the sports award. The expected gain from an extra hour hitting the books won't be, say, $1, but $1 minus the likely reduction in the sports prize. The two rewards might not totally offset each other, as the kid could spend more time studying and practicing with less time for sleeping and eating. In fact, mathematical models show that the overall strength of incentives in such situations is inversely proportional to the number of different bosses. That may explain why it is so difficult to get anything done in international bodies like the United Nations and the World Trade Organization. All sovereign nations are separate bosses. In the extreme situation where the owner's interests are totally opposed, aggregate incentives may be totally without power. That is like the admonition in the Bible, "No man can serve two masters, God and mammon." The idea is that interests of God and mammon are totally opposed. When the two are joint bosses, the incentives provided by one exactly cancel those provided by the other. How to reward work effort. We have illustrated the key elements of a well-designed incentive scheme. Now, we want to flesh out some of these principles through more developed examples. Imagine you are the owner of a high-tech company trying to develop and market a new computer chess game, Wizard 1.0. If you succeed, you will make a profit of $200,000 from the sales. If you fail, you make nothing. Success or failure hinges on what your expert player programmer does. She can either put her heart and soul into the work or just give it a routine shot. With high-quality effort, the chances of success are 80%, but for routine effort, the figure drops to 60%. Chess programmers can be hired for $50,000, but they like to daydream and will give only their routine effort for this sum. For high-quality effort, you have to pay $70,000. What should you do? As shown in the following table, a routine effort will get you $200,000 with a 60% chance, which comes out to $120,000 on average. Subtracting the $50,000 salary leaves an average profit of $70,000. The corresponding calculation, if you hire a high-effort expert, is 80% of $200,000 minus $70,000, that is $90,000. Clearly, you do better to hire a high-effort expert at the higher salary. But there is a problem. You can't tell by looking at the expert's work whether she is exerting routine effort or quality effort. The creative process is mysterious. The drawings on your programmer's pad may be the key to a great graphics display that will ensure the success of Wizard 1.0, or just doodles of pawns and bishops to accompany her daydreaming. Knowing that you can't tell the difference between routine effort and quality effort, what is to prevent the expert from accepting the salary of $70,000 appropriate for high effort, but exerting routine effort just the same? Even if the project fails, that can always be blamed on chance. After all, even with genuine quality effort, the project can fail 20% of the time. When you can't observe the quality of effort, we know that you have to base your reward scheme on something you can observe. In the present instance, the only thing that can be observed is the ultimate outcome, namely success or failure of the programming effort. This does have a link to effort, albeit an imperfect one. Higher quality of effort means a greater chance of success. This link can be exploited to generate an incentive scheme. What you do is offer the expert a remuneration that depends on the outcome. A larger sum upon success and a smaller sum in the event of failure. The difference, or the bonus for success, should be just enough to make it in the employee's own interest to provide high quality effort. In this case, the bonus must be big enough so that the expert expects a high effort will raise her earnings by $20,000 from $50,000 to $70,000. Hence, the bonus for success has to be at least $100,000, a 20% increase from 60 to 80% in the chance of getting a $100,000 bonus provides the necessary $20,000 expected payment for motivating high-quality effort. We now know the bonus, but we don't know the base rate, the amount paid in the event of a failure. That needs a little calculation. Since even low effort has a 60% chance of success, the $100,000 bonus provides an expected $60,000 payment for low effort. This is $10,000 more than the market requires. Thus, the base pay is negative $10,000. You should pay the employee $90,000 for success, and she should pay you a fine of $10,000 in the event of failure. Thus, with this incentive scheme, the programmer's incremental reward for success is $100,000, the minimum necessary for inducing quality effort. The average payment to her is $70,000, an 80% chance of $90,000, and a 20% chance of negative $10,000. This pay scheme leaves you, the owner, an average profit of $90,000. An 80% chance of $200,000 minus the average salary of $70,000. Another way of saying this is that on average, your revenue is $160,000 and your average cost is what the worker expects to earn, namely $70,000. This is exactly what you could have gotten if you could observe quality of effort by direct supervision. The incentive scheme has done a perfect job. The unobservability of effort hasn't made any difference. In essence, this incentive scheme sells 50% of the firm to the programmer in exchange for $10,000 and her effort. Recall that a successful project is worth $200,000. Since the employee is paid a bonus of $100,000 for success, it is just as if the employee owns half the business. Her net payments are then either $90,000 or negative $10,000, and with so much riding on the outcome of the project, it becomes in her interest to supply high-quality effort in order to increase the chance of success, and her profit share of $100,000. The only difference between this contract and the fine bonus scheme is in the name. While the name may matter, we see there is more than one way to achieve the same effect. But these solutions may not be possible either because assessing a fine on an employee may not be legal or because the worker does not have sufficient capital to pay the $10,000 for her 50% stake. What do you do then? The answer is to go as close to the fine solution or equity sharing as you can. Since the minimum effective bonus is $100,000, the worker gets $100,000 in the event of success and nothing upon failure. Now, the employee's average receipt is $80,000, and your profit falls to $80,000 since your average revenue remains $160,000. With equity sharing, the worker has only her labor and no capital to invest in the project, but she still has to be given a 50% share to motivate her to supply high-quality effort. So the best you can do is sell her 50% of the company for her labor alone. The inability to enforce fines or get workers to invest their own capital means that the outcome is less good from your point of view, in this case by $10,000. Now, the unobservability of effort makes a difference. Another difficulty with the bonus scheme or equity sharing is the problem of risk. The worker's incentives arise from her taking a $100,000 gamble, but this rather large risk may lead the employee to value her compensation at less than its average of $70,000. In this case, the worker has to be compensated both for supplying high-quality effort and for bearing risk. The bigger the risk, the bigger the compensation. This extra compensation is another cost of a firm's inability to monitor its workers' efforts. Often the best solution is a compromise. Risk is reduced by giving the worker less than ideal incentives, and consequently, this motivates less than an ideal amount of effort. In other instances, you may have other indicators of the quality of effort, and you can and should use them when designing your incentive scheme. Perhaps the most interesting and common situation is one in which there are several such projects. Even though success is only an inexact statistical indicator of the quality of effort, it can be made more precise if there are more observations. There are two ways in which this can be done. If the same expert works for you on many projects, then you can keep a record of her string of successes and failures. You can be more confident in attributing repeated failure to poor effort rather than to chance. The greater accuracy of your inference allows you to design a better incentive scheme. The second possibility is that you have several experts working on related projects, and there is some correlation in the success or failure of the projects. If one expert fails while others around her are succeeding, then you can be more confident that she is a shirker and not just unlucky. Therefore, rewards based on relative performance, in other words, prizes, will generate suitable incentives. Case study. Treat them like royalty. The typical way that authors get paid for writing a book is via a royalty arrangement. For every book sold, the author gets a certain percentage, something like 15% of the list price on hardcover sales and 10% for paperback. The author might also get an advance against future royalties. This advance is usually paid in parts, one part upon signing of the contract, another upon delivery and acceptance of the manuscript, and the rest upon publication. How does this payment system create the right incentives, and where might it create a wedge between the interests of the publishing house and those of the author? Is there a better way to pay authors? Case discussion. The only good author is a dead author. Patrick O'Connor. An editor is one who separates the wheat from the chaff and prints the chaff. Adlai Stevenson. As these quotes suggest, there are many possible sources of tension in the relationship between authors and publishers. The contract helps resolve some of the problems and creates others. Holding back on some of the advance gives the author an incentive to complete the book on time. The advance also transfers risk from the author to the publisher, who might be in a better position to spread the risk over a large number of projects. The size of the advance is also a credible signal that the publisher is truly excited about the prospects for the book. Any publisher can say that they love the book proposal, but actually offering a large advance will be much more costly if you don't believe that the book will sell a large number of copies. One place where authors and publishers disagree is over the list price of the book. You might at first think that since authors are getting a percentage of the list price, they would want the price to be high. But what authors are really getting is a percentage of total revenue, say 15% in the case of the hardcover sales. Thus, what authors really care about is total revenue. They would like the publishing house to pick a list price that maximizes total revenue. The publisher, on the other hand, seeks to maximize its profits. Profits are revenue net of cost. What that means is that the publisher always wants to charge a higher price than would maximize revenue. If the publisher were to start at the revenue maximizing price and go up a little bit, that would keep revenue almost constant, but would reduce sales and thus cut costs. In our case, we anticipated this issue in advance and negotiated the list price as part of the contract. You are welcome. And thanks for reading the book. There are two more cases on incentives in the next chapter. Bay Bridge and But One Life to Lay Down for Your Country. Trip to the Gym Number 10. How big is the wedge between publishers and authors? Try to estimate how much more the publisher would like to charge compared to the author. Chapter 14. Case studies. The other person's envelope is always greener. The inevitable truth about gambling is that one person's gain must be another person's loss. Thus, it is especially important to evaluate a gamble from the other side's perspective before accepting. If they are willing to gamble, they expect to win, which means they expect you to lose. Someone must be wrong, but who? This case study looks at a bet that seems to profit both sides. That can't be right, but where's the flaw? There are two envelopes, each containing an amount of money. The amount of money is either $5, $10, $20, $40, $80, or $160, and everybody knows this. Furthermore, we are told that one envelope contains exactly twice as much money as the other. The two envelopes are shuffled, and we give one envelope to Ali and one to Baba. After both the envelopes are opened, but the amounts inside are kept private, Ali and Baba are given the opportunity to switch. If both parties want to switch, we let them. Suppose Baba opens his envelope and sees $20. He reasons as follows. Ali is equally likely to have $10 or $40. Thus, my expected reward if I switch envelopes is 10 plus 40 divided by 2 equals $25 is greater than $20. For gambles this small, the risk is unimportant, so it is in my interest to switch. By a similar argument, Ali will want to switch whether she sees $10, since she figures that he will get either $5 or $20, which has an average of $12.50, or $40, since she figures to get either $20 or $80, which has an average of $50. Something is wrong here. Both parties can't be better off by switching envelopes, since the amount of money to go around is not getting any bigger by switching. What is the mistaken reasoning? Should Ali and or Baba offer to switch? Case discussion. A switch should never occur if Ali and Baba are both rational and assume that the other is too. The flaw in the reasoning is the assumption that the other side's willingness to switch envelopes does not reveal any information. We solve the problem by looking deeper into what each side thinks about the other's thought process. First, we take Ali's perspective about what Baba thinks. Then, we use this from Baba's perspective to imagine what Ali might be thinking about him. Finally, we go back to Ali and consider what she should think about how Baba thinks Ali thinks about Baba. Actually, this all sounds much more complicated than it is. Using the example, the steps are easier to follow. Suppose that Ali opens her envelope and sees $160. In that case, she knows that she has the greater amount and hence is unwilling to participate in a trade. Since Ali won't trade when she has $160, Baba should refuse to switch envelopes when he has $80, for the only time Ali might trade with him occurs when Ali has $40, in which case Baba prefers to keep his original $80. But if Baba won't switch when he has $80, then Ali shouldn't want to trade envelopes when she has $40, since a trade will result only when Baba has $20. Now we have arrived at the case in hand. If Ali doesn't want to switch envelopes when she has $40, then there is no gain from trade when Baba finds $20 in his envelope. He doesn't want to trade his $20 for $10. The only person who is willing to trade is someone who finds $5 in the envelope. But of course, the other side doesn't want to trade with him. Here's mud in your eye. One of our colleagues decided to go to a Jackson Browne concert at Saratoga Springs. He was one of the first to arrive and scouted the area for the best place to sit. It had rained recently and the area in front of the stage was all muddy. Our colleague settled on the front row closest to the stage, yet still behind the muddied area. Where did he go wrong? Case discussion. No, the mistake wasn't in picking Jackson Browne. His 1972 hit song, Doctor My Eyes, is still a classic. The mistake was in not looking ahead. As the crowd arrived, the lawn filled up until there was nowhere behind him left to sit. At that point, latecomers ventured into the muddied region. Of course, nobody wanted to sit down there, so they stood. Our colleague's view was completely blocked, and his blanket equally darkened by the masses of muddied feet. Here's a case where look forward and reason backward would have made all the difference. The trick is to not choose the best place to sit independently of what others are doing. You have to anticipate where the late arrivals are going to go, and based on this prediction, choose what you anticipate will be the best seat. As the great Gretzky said in another context, you have to skate to where the puck will be, not where it is. Red, I win, black, you lose. While we might never get the chance to skipper in an America's Cup race, one of us found himself with a very similar problem. At the end of his academic studies, Barry celebrated at one of Cambridge University's May balls, the English equivalent of a college prom. Part of the festivities included a casino. Everyone was given £20 worth of chips, and the person who had amassed the greatest fortune by evening's end would win a free ticket to next year's ball. When it came time for the last spin of the roulette wheel, by a happy coincidence, Barry led with £700 worth of chips, and the next closest was a young English woman with £300. The rest of the group had been effectively cleaned out. Just before the last bets were to be placed, the woman offered to split next year's ball ticket, but Barry refused. With his substantial lead, there was little reason to settle for half. To better understand the next strategic move, we take a brief detour to the rules of roulette. The betting in roulette is based on where a ball will land when the spinning wheel stops. There are typically numbers 0 through 36 on the wheel. When the ball lands on 0, the house wins. The safest bet in roulette is to bet on even or odd, denoted by black or red. These bets pay even money. A $1 bet returns $2, while the chance of winning is only 18 out of 37. Even betting her entire stake would not lead to victory at these odds. Therefore, the woman was forced to take one of the more risky gambles. She bet her entire stake on the chance that the ball would land on a multiple of 3. This bet pays 2-1, so her £300 bet would return £900 if she won, but has only a 12-37 chance of winning. She placed her bet on the table. At that point, it could not be withdrawn. What should Barry have done? Case discussion. Barry should have copied the woman's bet and placed £300 on the chance that the ball would land on a multiple of 3. This would have guaranteed that he stayed ahead of her by £400 and won the ticket. Either they both would lose the bet, and Barry would win £400 to £0, or they both would win the bet and Barry would end up ahead £1,300 to £900. The woman had no other choice. If she did not bet, she would have lost anyway. Whatever she bet on, Barry could have followed her and stayed ahead. Her only hope was that Barry would bet first. If Barry had been first to place £200 on black, what should she have done? She should have bet her £300 on red. Betting her stake on black would do her no good, since she would win only when Barry won, and she would place second with £600, compared with Barry's £900. Winning when Barry lost would be her only chance to take the lead, and that dictated a bet on red. The strategic moral is the opposite to that of our tales of Martin Luther and Charles de Gaulle. In this tale of roulette, the person who moved first was at a disadvantage. The woman, by betting first, allowed Barry to choose a strategy that would guarantee victory. If Barry had bet first, the woman could have chosen a response that offered an even chance of winning. The general point is that in games, it is not always an advantage to seize the initiative and move first. This reveals your hand, and the other players can use this to their advantage and your cost. Second movers may be in the stronger strategic position. The shark repellent that backfired. Corporations have adopted many new and innovative ways, often called shark repellent, to prevent outside investors from taking over their company. Without commenting on the efficiency or even morality of these ploys, we present a new and as yet untested variety of shark repellent and ask you to consider how to overcome it. The target company is Piper's Pickled Peppers. Although now publicly held, the old family ties remain, as the five-member board of directors is completely controlled by five of the founder's grandchildren. The founder recognized the possibility of conflict between his grandchildren as well as the threat of outsiders. To guard against both family squabbles and outsider attacks, he first required that the board of directors' elections be staggered. This means that even someone who owns 100% of the shares cannot replace the entire board. Rather, only the members whose terms are expiring. Each of the five members had a staggered five-year term. An outsider could hope to get at most one seat a year. Taken at face value, it appeared that it would take someone 3 years to get a majority and control of the company. The founder was worried that his idea of staggered terms would be subject to change if a hostile party wrested control of the shares. A second provision was therefore added. The procedure for board election could be changed only by the board itself. Any board member could make a proposal without the need for a seconder. But there was a major catch. The proposer would be required to vote for his own proposal. The voting would then proceed in clockwise order around the boardroom table. To pass, a proposal needed at least 50% of the total board. Absences were counted as votes against. Given that there were only five members, that meant at least 3 out of 5. Here's the rub. Any person who made a proposal to change either the membership of the board or the rules governing how membership was determined would be deprived of his position on the board and his stock holdings if his proposal failed. The holdings would be distributed evenly among the remaining members of the board. In addition, any board member who voted for a proposal that failed would also lose his seat on the board and his holdings. For a while, this provision proved successful in fending off hostile bidders. But then Seashells by the Seashore Limited bought 51% of the shares in a hostile takeover attempt. Seashells voted itself one seat on the board at the annual election. But it did not appear that loss of control was imminent, as Seashells was one lone voice against four. At their first board meeting, Seashells proposed a radical restructuring of the board membership. This was the first such proposal that the board had ever voted on. Not only did the Seashells proposal pass, amazingly, it passed unanimously. As a result, Seashells got to replace the entire board immediately. The old directors were given a lead parachute, which is still better than nothing, and then were shown the door. How did Seashells do it? Hint. It was pretty devious. Backward reasoning is the key. First, work on a scheme to get the resolution to pass, and then you can worry about unanimity. To ensure that the Seashells proposal passes, start at the end and make sure that the final two voters have an incentive to vote for the proposal. This will be enough to pass the resolution, since Seashells starts the process with a first yes vote. Case discussion. Many proposals do the trick. Here's one of them. Seashells' restructuring proposal has the following three cases. Number one. If the proposal passes unanimously, then Seashells chooses an entirely new board. Each board member replaced is given a small compensation. Number two, if the proposal passes 4-1, then the person voting against is removed from the board and no compensation is made. Number three, if the proposal passes with a vote of 3-2, then Seashells transfers the entirety of its 51% share of Piper's Pickled Peppers to the other two yes voters in equal proportion. The two no voters are removed from the board with no compensation. At this point, backward reasoning finishes the story. Imagine that the vote comes down to the wire. The last voter is faced with a 2-2 count. If he votes yes, it passes, and he gets 25.5% of the company's stock. If it fails, Seashell's assets and the other yes voters' shares are distributed evenly among the three remaining members. So he gets 51 plus 12.25 divided by 3 equals 21.1% of the company's stock. He'll say yes. Everyone can thereby use backward reasoning to predict that if it comes down to a 2-2 tie-breaking vote, Seashells will win when the final vote is cast. Now look at the fourth voter's dilemma. When it is his turn to vote, the other votes are 1, 1 yes, Seashells. 2, 2 yes. Or 3, 3 yes. If there are 3 yes votes, the proposal has already passed. The fourth voter would prefer to get something over nothing and therefore votes yes. If there are 2 yes votes, he can predict that the final voter will vote yes even if he votes no. The fourth voter cannot stop the proposal from passing. Hence, again, it is better to be on the winning side, so he will vote yes. Finally, if he sees only 1 yes vote, then he would be willing to bring the vote to a 2-2 tie. He can safely predict that the final voter will vote yes, and the two of them will make out very nicely indeed. The first two Piper's board members are now in a true pickle. They can predict that even if they both vote no, the last two will go against them and the proposal will pass. Given that they can't stop it from passing, it is better to go along and get something. This case demonstrates the power of backward reasoning. Of course, it helps to be devious, too. Tough Guy Tender Offer. When Robert Campeau made his first bid for Federated Stores and its crown jewel, Bloomingdale's, he used the strategy of a two-tiered tender offer. A two-tiered bid typically offers a high price for the first shares tendered and a lower price to the shares tendered later. To keep numbers simple, we look at a case in which the pre-takeover price is $100 per share. The first tier of the bid offers a higher price, $105 per share, to the first shareholders until half of the total shares are tendered. The next 50% of the shares tendered fall into the second tier. The price paid for these shares is only $90 per share. For fairness, shares are not placed in the different tiers based on the order in which they are tendered. Rather, everyone gets a blended price. All the shares tendered are placed on a prorated basis into the two tiers. Those who don't tender find all of their shares end up in the second tier if the bid succeeds. We can express the average payment for shares by a simple algebraic expression. If fewer than 50% tender, everyone gets $105 per share. If an amount, X percent, is greater than or equal to 50% of the company's total stock gets tendered, then the average price paid per share is $105 times 50 over X plus $90 times X minus 50 over X equals $90 plus $15 times 50 over X. One thing to notice about the way the two-tiered offer is made is that it is unconditional. Even if the raider does not get control, the tendered shares are still purchased at the first-tier price. The second feature to note about the way this two-tiered offer works is that if everyone tenders, then the average price per share is only $97.50. This is less than the price before the offer. It's also worse than what they expect should the takeover fail. If the raider is defeated, shareholders expect the price to return to the $100 level. Hence, they hope that the offer is defeated or that another raider comes along. In fact, another raider did come along, namely Macy's. Imagine that Macy's makes a conditional tender offer. It offers $102 per share provided it gets a majority of the shares. To whom do you tender and which, if either, offer do you expect to succeed? Case discussion. Tendering to the two-tiered offer is a dominant strategy. To verify this, we consider all the possible cases. There are three possibilities to check. The two-tiered offer attracts less than 50% of the total shares and fails. The two-tiered offer attracts some amount above 50% and succeeds. The two-tiered offer attracts exactly 50%. If you tender, the offer will succeed, and without you, it fails. In the first case, the two-tiered offer fails, so that the post-tender price is either $100 if both offers fail or $102 if the competing offer succeeds. But if you tender, you get $105 per share, which is bigger than either alternative. In the second case, if you don't tender, you get only $90 per share. Tendering gives you, at worst, $97.50. So again, it is better to tender. In the third case, while other people are worse off if the offer succeeds, you are privately better off. The reason is that since there are exactly 50% tendered, you will be getting $105 per share. This is worthwhile. Thus, you are willing to push the offer over. Because tendering is a dominant strategy, we expect everyone to tender. When everyone tenders, the average blended price per share may be below the pre-bid price and even below the expected future price should the offer fail. Hence, the two-tiered bid enables a raider to pay less than the company is worth. The fact that shareholders have a dominant strategy does not mean that they end up ahead. The raider uses the low price of the second tier to gain an unfair advantage. Usually, the manipulative nature of the second tier is less stark than in our example, because the coercion is partially hidden by the takeover premium. If the company is really worth $110 after the takeover, then the raider can still gain an unfair advantage by using a second tier below $110, but above $100. Lawyers view the two-tiered bid as coercive and have successfully used this as an argument to fight the raider in court. In the battle for Bloomingdale's, Robert Kumpo eventually won, but with a modified offer that did not include any tiered structure. We also see that a conditional bid is not an effective counter-strategy against an unconditional two-tiered bid. In our example, the bid by Macy's would be much more effective if its offer of $102 per share were made unconditionally. An unconditional bid by Macy's destroys the equilibrium in which the two-tiered bid succeeds. The reason is that if people thought that the two-tiered bid were certain to succeed, they would expect a blended price of $97.50, which is less than they would receive by tendering to Macy's. Hence, it cannot be that shareholders expect the two-tiered bid to succeed and still tender to it. Unfortunately, it is not an equilibrium for Macy's bid to succeed either, for in that case, the two-tiered bid would attract less than 50% of the shares, and so the price per share offered would be above the bid by Macy's. Alas, this is one of those cases with no equilibrium. Finding a solution requires the use of randomized strategies as discussed in Chapter 5. In late 1989, Kumpo's operations unraveled because of excessive debt. Federated Stores filed for reorganization under Chapter 11 of the bankruptcy law. When we say Kumpo's strategy was successful, we merely mean that it achieved the aim of winning the takeover battle. Success in running the company was a different game. The safer duel. As pistols become more accurate, does that change the deadliness of a duel? Case discussion. At first glance, the answer would seem to be obvious, yes. But recall that the players will adapt their strategies to the new situation. Indeed, the answer is easier to see if we flip the question. Suppose we try to make dueling safer by reducing the accuracy of the pistols. The new outcome is that the adversaries will come closer to one another before firing. Recall our discussion of the duel on page 324. Each player waits to shoot until the point where his probability of hitting the other side is just equal to the other side's chance of missing. Note that the accuracy of the pistols doesn't enter into the equation. All that matters is the ultimate chance of success. To illustrate this point with some numbers, suppose that the adversaries are equally good shots. Then, the optimal strategy is for the two to keep on approaching each other until the moment that the probability of hitting reaches one half. At that point, one duelist takes a shot. It doesn't matter which person shoots, as the chance of success is a half for the shooter and a half for the person who is being shot at. The probability each player will survive is the same, one half, irrespective of the accuracy of the pistols. A change in the rules need not affect the outcome. All the players will adjust their strategies to offset it. The three-way duel. Three antagonists, Larry, Moe, and Curly, are engaged in a three-way duel. There are two rounds. In the first round, each player is given one shot. First Larry, then Moe, and then Curly. After the first round, any survivors are given a second shot, again, beginning with Larry, then Moe, and then Curly. For each duelist, the best outcome is to be the sole survivor. Next best is to be one of two survivors. In third place is the outcome in which no one gets killed. Dead last is that you get killed. Larry is a poor shot, with only a 30% chance of hitting a person at whom he aims. Moe is a much better shot, achieving 80% accuracy. Curly is a perfect shot. He never misses. What is Larry's optimal strategy in the first round? Who has the greatest chance of survival in this problem? Case discussion. Although backward reasoning is the safe way to solve this problem, we can jump ahead a little by using some forward-looking arguments. We start by examining each of Larry's options in turn. What happens if Larry shoots at Moe? What happens if Larry shoots at Curly? If Larry shoots at Moe and hits, then he signs his own death warrant. It becomes Curly's turn to shoot, and he never misses. Curly will not pass at the chance to shoot Larry, as this leads to his best outcome. Larry shooting at Moe does not seem to be a very attractive option. If Larry shoots at Curly and hits, then it is Moe's turn. Moe will shoot at Larry. Think about how we know this to be true. Hence, if Larry hits Curly, his chance of survival is less than 20%, the chance that Moe misses. So far, neither of these options looks to be very attractive. In fact, Larry's best strategy is to fire up in the air. In this case, Moe will shoot at Curly, and if he misses, Curly will shoot and kill Moe. Then it becomes the second round, and it is Larry's turn to shoot again. Since only one other person remains, he has at least a 30% chance of survival, since that is the probability that he kills his one remaining opponent. The moral here is that small fish may do better by passing on their first chance to become stars. We see this every 4 years in presidential campaigns. When there is a large number of contenders, the leader of the pack often gets derailed by the cumulative attacks of all the medium-sized fish. It can be advantageous to wait and step into the limelight only after the others have knocked each other and themselves out of the running. Your chances of survival depend on not only your own ability, but also whom you threaten. A weak player who threatens no one may end up surviving if the stronger players kill each other off. Curly, although he is the most accurate, has the lowest chance of survival, only 14%. So much for survival of the fittest. Moe has a 56% chance of winning. Larry's best strategy turns his 30% accuracy into a 41.2% chance of winning. The risk of winning. One of the more unusual features of a Vickrey sealed bid auction is that the winning bidder does not know how much she will have to pay until the auction is over and she has won. Remember, in a Vickrey auction, the winning bidder pays only the second highest bid. In contrast, there is no uncertainty in the more standard sealed bid auction, in which the winner pays her bid. Since everyone knows her own bid, no one has any doubts as to how much she will have to pay if she wins. The presence of uncertainty suggests that we might want to consider the effect of risk on the participants' bidding strategies. The typical response to uncertainty is negative. The bidders are worse off in a Vickrey auction because they do not know how much they will have to pay if they have submitted the winning bid. Is it reasonable that a bidder will respond to this uncertainty or risk by lowering her bid below the true valuation? Case discussion. It is true that the bidders dislike the uncertainty associated with how much they might have to pay if they win. Each is, in fact, worse off. Yet in spite of the risk, participants should still bid their true valuations. The reason is that a truthful bid is a dominant strategy. As long as the selling price is below the valuation, the bidder wants to buy the good. The only way to ensure that you win whenever the price is below your value is to bid the true value. In a Vickrey auction, bidding the true valuation doesn't make you pay more, except when someone else would have outbid you, in which case you would have wanted to raise your bid until the selling price exceeded your valuation. The risk associated with a Vickrey auction is limited. The winner is never forced to pay an amount greater than her bid. While there is uncertainty about what the winner will pay, the uncertainty is only over the degree of good news. Even though the good news might be variable, the best strategy is to win the auction whenever it's profitable. That means bidding your true value. You never miss a profitable opportunity, and whenever you win, you pay less than your true value. But one life to lay down for your country. How can the commanders of an army motivate its soldiers to risk their lives for their country? Most armies would be finished if each soldier on the battlefield started to make a rational calculation of the costs and benefits of risking his own life. What are the various devices that can motivate and incentivize soldiers to risk their lives? Case discussion. First, look at some devices that transform the soldier's self-regarding rationality. The process begins in boot camp. Basic training in the armed forces everywhere is a traumatic experience. The new recruit is maltreated, humiliated, and put under such immense physical and mental strain that the few weeks quite alter his personality. An important habit acquired in this process is an automatic, unquestioning obedience. There is no reason why socks should be folded or beds made in a particular way except that the officer has so ordered. The idea is that the same obedience will occur when the order is of greater importance. Trained not to question orders, the soldier becomes a fighting machine. Commitment is automatic. Many armies got their soldiers drunk before battle. This may have reduced their fighting efficiency, but it also reduced their capacity for rational calculation of self-preservation. The seeming irrationality of each soldier turns into strategic rationality. Shakespeare knew this perfectly well. In Henry V, the night before the Battle of Agincourt, fought on St. Crispin's Day, October 25, 1415, King Henry prays, "O God of battles, steal my soldiers' hearts, possess them not with fear, take from them now the sense of reckoning, if the opposed numbers pluck their hearts from them." Just before the battle, Henry does something that may at first seem to defeat his purpose. Instead of enforcing any compulsion to fight, he declares, "He which hath no stomach to this fight, let him depart. His passport shall be made, and crowns for convoy put into his purse. We would not die in that man's company that fears his fellowship to die with us." The catch is that anyone who wants to take up this offer has to do so in full view of all of his companions. Of course, everyone is too ashamed to do so. And the action, actually inaction, of publicly declining the offer changes soldiers' preferences, even personalities, irrevocably. By their act of rejecting the offer, the soldiers have psychologically burned their ship's home. They have established an implicit contract with each other not to flinch from death if the time comes. Next, consider incentives to act. These can be material. In the old days, victorious soldiers had the opportunity to loot from the property and even the bodies of the enemy. Generous death benefits can be promised for next of kin if the worst happens. But the incentives to fight and risk lives are mostly non-material. Medals, honor, and glory come to the brave whether they live or die in battle. The lucky survivors can boast of their exploits for years to come. Here is Shakespeare's King Henry V again. "He that shall live this day and see old age will yearly on the vigil feast his neighbors, He'll remember, with advantages, what feats he did that day. And Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by, from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. And gentlemen, in England now abed, shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whiles any speak.